What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning into the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and I have a very special show for all you musicians out there. I have a returning guest who I requested to come back on the show to share his expertise and knowledge with the front end side of music, publishing, copyrights, and contracts. Please welcome back music attorney, drummer, percussionist, Mr. Paul Quinn. How's it going, Paul?
It's going great, Spud. How you doing, sir? Thank you very much for having me back on your show.
Oh, man, it's a pleasure, Paul. You know, the main reason I wanted to have you back is, you know, to talk about some of the details and specifics on publishing copyrights and contracts, because, you know, a lot of times, you know, we're so focused on our art side of music that we tend to forget to study and educate ourselves about the back end, the business, protecting ourselves and our craft. So, man, I just wanted to get to the source and have you back and, you know, teach us.
Well, you're kind, but you do. You raise a very, very, very good point. I mean, the fact is that creative people tend to believe that there's something crass about being involved in the business side of our profession. And I try and tell my clients when they come to see me that when you're negotiating a deal with a record company or a publishing company or a management company or a promotion company, do you think for 1 minute that they don't have a lawyer? And of course, they'll say, well, yeah, they have a lawyer. And the law is a game that only those educated in it can play. It's a mystical language, and it's a complex issue. If you don't have a lawyer, you're not competing on a level playing field. And the truth of the matter is there's billions of dollars, that's with a B, that exchange hands during the course of any calendar year in our business. And if you don't understand the business side of it, you don't protect yourself at the front end, then that money's going somewhere else, and it's not going to you.
Wow. You know, so if you can give me just some brief descriptions on how publishing works, how it ties into the contracts, and from there, protecting ourselves. I mean, usually, generally, when you receive a new client, what's some of the things that you kind of just focus on with them at the beginning stages of their career?
Well, let me touch on a couple of things before we get back to the publishing, because that's a slightly separate issue. But the first thing I tell all my clients to do when they come to see me is to form a business entity. And by a business entity, I mean to form a corporation, to form an LLC, to form, even if it's a partnership, although that's not really ideal. And there are a variety of reasons for that. First of all, it's easy to form a corporation. You should have a lawyer do it, but, you know, most lawyers can get that taken care of for you for anywhere from $500 to $1,200, depending upon where you are. The reasons why you form a business entity are many, but the two primary ones is they probably give you tax advantages, but they certainly give you liability advantages. For example, a corporation, you know, it's a legal fiction. As far as the law is concerned, a corporation is a person, and the same for an LLC. So you form your corporation, you give it its appropriate name, you pay your filing fee, and that's who you do business with. So even if it's just you, what happens is your corporation then hires you and pays you your salary. How that protects you is we live in a very litigious society. You know, it's just a matter of time before somebody gets sued. And it can be a whole variety of reasons why you might get sued. You know, you could have an agreement to turn up at a certain club to play a date and you have a blowout on the way, you don't make it, they may sue you if they've sold tickets. Well, if you're just you and you're Spud playing a gig somewhere and they've hired Spud, not Spud LLC, what's going to happen is when they sue you, if they prevail, they're coming after your car, your TV, your waterbed, and your stereo. If you have a corporation, all they can get from you, assuming they prevail, is what's in your corporation. And, you know, you run a small corporation, an S corporation, in an intelligent way, and you know, all they can get is the contents of that bank account. Well, if you pay yourself your salary and you take care of things properly and you pay attention to corporate formalities, it leaves you in a much healthier position. So I tell everybody, make sure that you incorporate. Of course, there are other reasons why it's good, too, because, you know, you look more businesslike. You can have a bank account in the name of your corporation. You can have business cards with the name of your corporation on it. And there's something about organizing a business that just makes you feel more businesslike. Mm-hmm. You know, it never ceases to amaze me that in our business, if three guys are getting together to form a business to go fix toilets, chances are they'll hire a lawyer, have a partnership agreement, form a corporation, have a logo, trademark the logo, and go out and make their business. But three guys that want to get together to play in a band never seem to do that. And I don't really understand why that would be the case, when the chances of making so much more money as a band member than as a toilet repairer, I mean, the chances are just much greater.
Yeah, I agree.
So the first piece of advice I give people, form a legal organization. And then if there's more than one of you, you need a partnership agreement amongst yourselves. And for example, if you're a band, you need a band agreement. And I am amazed by how few bands have a band agreement. And band agreements are like prenups. You know, I'm sure we all know folks who have got married and then later got divorced and have said, well, we didn't get a prenup because everything was great at the time and we didn't think everything would turn to hell. Well, bands are just the same. Sometimes everything's wonderful and so you think, I don't need an agreement. But, you know, there's more litigation amongst band members when bands split up than, you know, you can shake a stick at. They're suing all the time over a variety of issues, you know, from who controls the name to who gets the gear. Who controls the name is a huge deal. You know, I mean, if you do a search of lawsuits, you'll find lawsuits that have been filed by Creedence Clearwater Revival, by Pink Floyd, Deep Purple, about who controls the name when members leave. So, you know, you need to have an agreement amongst you all, and you need to be incorporated.
Now, what are some of the things that any new band member or an artist or producer should look for when signing a contract? I mean, what are some of the red flags that you see on the first negotiations on a contract?
Well, you know, you ask a good question, and I'll tell you, what's interesting is often somebody will come to me after they've made the initial contact with a record company or with a management company, and the management company has sent them the agreement, and then they'll send the agreement to me, and they'll say, you know, I don't understand what all these terms mean. And what usually happens is I'll call the management company or the record company and I'll tell them I'm an attorney who's representing the artist, and 95% of the time they say, oh, you can disregard that agreement, we'll send you another one. And that's because there are things in that agreement that they know no lawyer would allow their client to sign, but they still expect people who are unrepresented to sign these things. And I'll give you an example. And maybe you can do it in the context of record contracts. I know that those things are not quite the same as they were 10 years ago, but things move very, very slowly in the legal side of this business. And so the standard record contract still involves an 85-15 split. 85% goes to the record company. It might vary. You might get 82% to the record company. You sometimes get 87% to the record company. And they're going to try and tie you to as long a deal as you can, as they can possibly tie you to. Because don't forget, they always have the right to drop you. You often don't have the right to get out the deal, but they want the right to drop you. So what they'll do is the first contract will usually say, we'll sign you to a term which involves the making of 5 CDs. Well, that's the very first thing that I strike out. 2 is preferable. Because, and you know, to make sure everybody understands why, if your first 2 CDs are successful, then they'll want to sign you again and you can renegotiate for a better deal. If your first 2 CDs are successful and they have you on a 5 CD deal, well, you're contractually obliged to continue to finish the contract and you don't get a chance to renegotiate. If your first 2 CDs are not successful, they'll drop you anyway. So it's, you know, it's a lose-lose situation if you don't get that changed.
Right.
But then, you know, there's all that legal language that means nothing. You know, there's that my say, notwithstanding the subsequent, the previous paragraph. And what that means is that thing you've just agreed to in the paragraph before doesn't matter for this paragraph coming up next.
Okay.
And, you know, that's confusing. And, you know,
sure.
The advantage of law school and doing this for a while is you can read those things. I can read a 60-page long-form contract probably in an hour.
Wow.
And I've known other people that have spent 6-7 days poring over it, and they still don't have a clue what it means.
Wow.
I guess the gist of all this is if you're going to take this seriously, you got to go get a lawyer. I tell all my guys, don't sign anything ever except an autograph without showing it to me first. And if somebody asks you to sign an autograph on a blank piece of paper that's 8.5 by 11, don't sign your autograph. The very first litigation case I had in the music business was a contract that my guy told me he'd never seen it before. And then they sent me a copy of the contract, and we used a forensic computer expert who could determine that the print of the contract had been put over the top of his signature. And what had happened is he'd signed an autograph on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, and they'd printed the contract over the top of it.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there's some shady people out there, you know.
Man, that's unreal.
Isn't that just unbelievable?
So what are some of the things that you fight for your artists when negotiating contracts? I mean, what are some of the key things that you automatically just want to eliminate and make it better for the artists? Not necessarily money-wise, but maybe career-wise, long-term-wise. Is there anything that really stands out to you?
Well, you know, honestly, it's really individually contract-driven. You know, I mean, the job of a lawyer is to make sure that you represent the best interests of your client. So you need to make sure that the contract is short enough that they can get out if it's not working. You know, and that's the problem with a lot of publishing contracts. Some publishers will try and sign you to a contract for 16 years, 20 years.
Sure.
And, you know, you need to make sure that that's not the case. Now, another thing is some contracts are long, but they don't have any performance standards written within them, which what I try and put in every contract is if you haven't, if you, the agent, manager, producer, publisher, if you haven't managed to accomplish these benchmarks within a certain amount of time, my guy has the right to get out the contract. Because one of the problems, especially with managers, is, you know, everybody seems to want to be a manager. And, you know, now with the internet, there are all these management contracts that people can pull out. Mm-hmm. And often these contracts last forever, you know, although it will be a five-year contract with three rights of renewal, meaning it can go for 20 years. And why would anyone sign any of those agreements? Because what happens to a lot of these guys is they might represent 40 bands, which means it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. If my guy's a nice guy, this manager, publisher might do nothing for him. So you have to have performance standards. You know, if you haven't managed to get my song played on national radio inside 12 months of my CD being released, I have a right to get out of this contract. If you don't get me on a major tour, meaning minimum 5,000-seater venues within 8 months of signing this agreement, I have the right to get out of this agreement. And, you know, a good manager, an accomplished manager, will agree to that.
Sure.
You know, and the other problem is in percentage, you know, because, you know, the top-level superstar managers might take as high as 17.5% or even 20% of your income. And then what happens is these young guys who want to be managers who don't know the business that well will find one of these contracts and they'll say, well, that's what I want too. And I often have to explain to them, who do you know? Who can you call and have pick up the phone? And they might say, well, you know, I know this person or I know this person. I'll say, no, the guy that gets 20% is the guy that can call Clive Davis and say, hey, Clive, how's the family?
Sure.
You know, and if you can't do that, then, you know, you get 12.5%. That's just the way it goes.
Yeah, that's pretty standard. That's pretty fair, to be honest with you.
And, you know, and the other thing, frankly, is people seem to want to have a worldwide contract, because now with the ability of the internet, folks say, well, you know, I want to be your manager, agent, worldwide, all territories across the world. And I'll talk to these people, well, who do you know in Japan?
Right.
Who do you know in Germany? And often they'll say, well, nobody. I'll say, well, why should I give you the sole and exclusive rights to control my artist's career in a country in which you know nobody?
Sure.
And those are things that, you know, are non-negotiable. If you can't show me that you can do something, then I'm not tying my client to an exclusive deal in a foreign country.
No, so. I totally agree. Because a lot of times, you know, talk is cheap a lot of times. And, you know, who are you truly representing is what I usually look at other people. It's like, man, if you don't have anybody on your roster that you're managing, how are you going to be able to manage me? I mean, just like I said, making those phone calls to the higher executives, you know, so we can bypass the middleman, and you're asking for 20% and you can't even get past the gatekeeper, you know?
Right, and the truth is that there are a lot of artists out there who will say, well, I'll sign that deal because, you know, 20% of whatever I make is fine, let's go for it, you know. But sure. Why would it, but the problem is all those deals are exclusive. So then some, and here's what a lot of unscrupulous managers do. They'll try and sign somebody to that deal, knowing they can't really do it, but thinking the artist is talented. And then what will happen is a larger, respectable, reputable management company will come around. And what they'll have to do is they'll have to buy the guy out of his agreement. And that's how those managers make their money. They'll come around and say, well, yeah, you know, I'd be willing to let him out of his deal with me, but you have to pay me $250,000.
Wow.
And if that happens, don't believe for 1 minute that that money comes out of the manager's pocket. It might be fronted by the manager, but he's getting all that back.
Wow. Okay.
So, you know, you can just end up in a terrible situation with a bad deal.
Yeah,
that's why the very first person... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, man, that's truly a bad deal. I mean, I think there's a lot of people out there who are stuck in it right now.
Well, you know, the very first person you should have on your team, and if you're going to think about yourself as a business, which is what you need to do, the very first person you should have on your team should be a lawyer. And whatever jurisdiction you live in, you should find out who the entertainment lawyers are in your area. You should call them. You should make an appointment to go see them. You should find out who they represent. You should find out what they do. You should find out how much they charge and for what things they won't charge. And that's how you should hire them. And frankly, the day you decide you don't trust your lawyer, fire them and go get another one.
Wow.
You know, a lawyer needs to be a member of your team. And frankly, a lawyer, people shy off from lawyers because they're expensive. And yeah, they are expensive because the market dictates how much they make.
Sure.
But your lawyer should save you money. And at the end of a couple of years, if you can't look back and say, look, I paid X amount to my lawyer, but if I hadn't had a lawyer and I had signed these agreements, I would be this much worse off. And if you can't say that, you need to fire him and go get another one.
No, I totally agree with you. You know, so we got all the contracts together, Paul. Now it's talking about protecting our craft, our works, our songs, and, you know, registering with the Library of Congress. What is the details and the procedures on that? And, you know, how is it overlooked a lot of times? Because, you know, with all the tracks that are being out there and floating around, I mean, sometimes everybody is unprotected at one point or another when you're sharing projects amongst each other.
Well, that's exactly true. Well, you know, and copyright. It is an aged system, and it's frankly it's fairly confusing, and it's something that can really trip you up in the end. Now, I'm not an intellectual property lawyer, and so when people come to me with trademark and copyright issues, I can give them basic advice, but essentially I send them to somebody that does that for a living. But you know, a copyright is exactly what it says. You know, it gives you your right to protect the unauthorized use of your original work. And that's how you make money, because people have to pay you a license fee or a royalty to use what you copyright. Now, you have to remember, you can't copyright an idea. You can only copyright something that's in a fixed medium. So it can be a lyric that you've written down. It can be a melody. It can be a loop. It can be whatever you want, but it has to be in a fixed medium. And one of the problems with copyright in this country is that copyright only recognizes the writer of the melody and the writer of the lyrics. And this can be hugely problematic for a drummer, for a bass player, for a guitarist who hasn't, you know, written the lyrics and the melody of the song. And, you know, I can give you a great example. I have a client, Jonathan Moffitt, who is was the drummer for Ashford and Simpson for a long time, was the drummer for Michael Jackson for a long time, Janet Jackson, Cameo, a whole bunch of other guys. He was asked to play on a session for a song, and he didn't like the groove. So he said to them, how about we slow it down? How about we play it more with kind of a dotted eighth note feel? How about we give it that little New Orleans swing feel? And they said, well, you know what? We love that. We love it so much. Why don't you do a four-bar intro just playing time before we come in? So he said, okay, that's a great idea. That's what I'll do. He got no writing credit for the song. And that drum intro has been sampled on over 100 different singles that have been released since that time. Now, of course, those people that sample them and release them pay a license fee to the owner of the copyright. And who owns the copyright? The people that wrote the melody and the lyrics to the song. So even though it's only his part of the song that gets sampled, and even though he wrote that part, he doesn't get any money for it.
Wow.
And I'll tell you what's very interesting is copyright, which always stays behind developments in technology, is really problematic in rap music because, you know, rap doesn't have what would be described as traditional melody. And, you know, this is a problem for a producer because a producer might use loops, samples, might use computer for a backing track. Then the guy comes in and writes the lyrics and sings the melody. Who's recognized as the author of that song under copyright? Just the guy who sings the melody and wrote the lyrics. And, you know, so that's something that you need to take care of on the front end. You need to have a deal with that person before the song is recorded that you're going to split the writing 50-50.
Oh. So let's say if we have a deal where it's not released yet, but it's a track that's in the works, and let's say we submit it to XYZ client for listen review. You don't hear back from them for a couple of months, maybe a year goes by, next thing you know, you hear your song on the radio, and you didn't get a chance to copyright that song, but you still have all the masters, the recording, the melody set, and everything's time-stamped and recorded on the PC or your computer. Is there anywhere to protect yourself in court if you wanted to fight for that song?
Absolutely there is. You know, now if you haven't registered it with the Library of Congress, you know, on an SR form, as a sound recording form, if you haven't done that, you have to do that before you can sue. Okay, so, but it doesn't matter. You know, that's just a way of recording it. And there was a time before everything was time-coded on the computer that you recorded it with the Library of Congress the second you did it because it provided you with proof that you wrote it first. But yes, what you would then have to prove is A, that you wrote it first, and B, that the other person has had the opportunity to hear it. Once you can get past that hurdle, then what you have to show at court is that these two pieces of music are sufficiently similar that the second one couldn't have been written in the absence of hearing the first.
Sure.
What I'm telling you now is what the law is on litigation and copyright, but I want to give you some real-world advice. If you really want to protect yourself for songs you've written, you have to make the song famous before someone else does.
Definitely.
Because the truth of the matter is it's very difficult to sue famous people because juries get starstruck. They just drew. You know, there are very few cases you can read where there are jury verdicts for the plaintiff. And when those happen, they're often settled for pennies on the dollar. I'll give you an example. Michael Bolton was sued for the song, How Am I Supposed to Live Without You?
Sure.
The guy showed that he had written the song first. He showed that Michael Bolton had opportunity to hear the song before him. And I'm not making a judgment as to whether, you know, Michael Bolton violated any copyright. I have no idea if he did or not. But it went before a jury. But the case settled, and the writer received $5,000. The song grossed more than $2
million. Wow.
Now, obviously, the writer firmly believed that his copyright had been violated, or he wouldn't have gone to the expense of filing the lawsuit. But the song, you know, that case was settled for $5,000. You know, and there are other cases. You know, Mick Jagger had a lawsuit over She's the Boss. Again, you know, that was the jury verdict was for Mick Jagger. Juries like famous people. It's hard to go in when you're not a famous person and not have the jury be starstruck over somebody sitting on the witness stand that they've seen on their TV.
You know, it's amazing, man. There's so many aspects to the business that I know for certain that a lot of guys who are coming out just overlook. You know, you're pretty much vulnerable when you're a new artist coming out there, you know, from the bad deals, you know, bad representation with your camp and, you know, just really not educating yourself on the business side of it, man. And, you know, these are tools that I feel that keeps your career, you know, in steady motion, you know, the more you educate yourself about the front end of music.
You're exactly right. And that's why, you know, a smart guy, a smart woman in this business will make sure that they copyright everything. Now, you know, remember that, you know, it's copyright as soon as it's put into a fixed medium. But, you know, if you want to get royalties on it, you need to register it with the Library of Congress. If you want to get, if you want to sue over it, you have to register it with the Library of Congress. Now, you know, a lot of people have asked me about the poor man's copyright, you know, and that's something where you take your lyrics or you take your CD and you stick it in an envelope and you seal it with sealing wax and you mail it to yourself. And that is a valid copyright for certain purposes in Canada and in the UK. But there's no indication in the US that that's valid. And in fact, when you look at the Copyright Act, because you have to register it with the Library of Congress before you can file a suit on it to get damages for it, I would suspect it's probably not.
Wow. I hear that a lot. Everybody, oh, I mailed it to myself and I'm holding on to it just in case it comes up, I'll pull it out. And wow, I didn't know that it was only in the UK and Canada.
Yeah, well, but I mean, the point is, I mean, it doesn't cost very much to register a song, and I forget what the price is.
It's like $34, yeah, under $40.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it's like $35 or $40.
Yeah.
And you can do it later, but just do it now. You know, get it done. And then get it, then it's passed and it's dealt with, you know. And, you know, you need to reserve the rights to your creation. That's what you need to do. You know, that's how you're going to protect yourself. And the other thing a smart writer is going to do is they're going to try and own their own publishing. And that's something that you can do easily. You know, if you form your own corporation, you can form, or LLC, you can form that company so it does everything for you. So, you know, you can hire yourself out as an employee and it can control your publishing at the same time. And, you know, it's kind of a... the way publishing works is kind of complex. You know, generally speaking, those companies that collect royalties are going to pay 50% to the publisher and 50% to the writer. But they're going to pay 50% to the writer's publishing company. So sometimes you end up having to form two, which is okay. And then you need to work out who you're going to register those with. You know, are you going to register your company with BMI? Or are you going to register it with ASCAP, or are you going to register it with CSEC? And you can only register with one of those companies. And, you know, I tend to guide my, I mean, they're all great companies. I tend to guide my guys towards ASCAP, because ASCAP is the American Society of Composers and Performers, and it's actually owned by the people that are members of it.
Sure.
So they distribute all money. They've got very, very few expenses.
Right. I'm a member of ASCAP, and yeah, I agree. It's a great company, man. So.
Yeah, I'm a member of ASCAP too, and you know, I like dealing with them. They're very easy. And then, of course, there are other ways you can collect your royalties too. You know, you can sign up with Harry Fox, the Harry Fox Agency. If you don't know who they are, go check them out on the web, hfa.org or .com, I'm not sure which. But if you just search under Google for a Harry Fox Agency, and, you know, they're a company that you sign up with them, and they'll go track those royalties that you're supposed to be getting if you release something.
Sure.
You know, royalty rates are not high. Mechanical license rates are not high. In fact, I think, and I haven't looked recently, but I think if the song is less than 5 minutes long, I think it's 9.1 cents for each song sold.
Wow.
And of course, that doesn't apply to the streaming sites. And that's a whole nother issue.
Yeah.
But,
because a lot of music now is getting over to the streaming side and to the internet world. And, you know, I just, you know, you read about stuff, everybody's trying to fight for the royalty rights of, you know, the artist getting paid for over the internet. Yeah.
Well, it's hard. It's hard to get paid, you know, for that
right.
stuff. You know, it's not, I mean, if you've written a song on a CD, you're going to get paid 9.1 cents, assuming the song's less than 5 minutes, for every CD that's sold.
Wow.
Or for, you know, and a similar rate for every download, if it's downloaded from, you know, iTunes or you know, DigiStation or one of those companies.
Sure.
You know, for the people that sign up and pay for streaming stuff, you know, that money just seems to disappear into some void to me, and I'm not sure I fully understand how it works, but I know it's fractions of a hundredth of a penny that you get paid for, you know, for those songs.
How does it work for radio play? Is it the same type of structure for payment, or is it a little different for radio play?
It's similar, but it's a little different. The rate is slightly different. It's less, and the problem is with policing, and that's why somebody like Harry Fox is a good person to do. You know, some of the more reputable, larger radio stations will actually track every song they play and will report to ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC what it is they play. Some of the others don't, and the truth of the matter is those agencies are not big enough or funded well enough to be able to actually monitor every radio station that plays every song. And so what happens is they'll take an average of what songs are played in a particular market, and then they'll bill those fees. But again, you know, there's, for a songwriter, radio play and television play especially is where you can make a large percentage of your money.
Wow. Paul, this information was so beneficial to me and to everybody who I know is listening. And, you know, it's just missing those steps and educating yourself of, okay, the music's together, but I want to be protected when I get out there nationally. And, you know, it's just a lot of times I see too many times where artists, they jump out, you know, and the sharks are at them right away. You know what I mean? They didn't have a chance. So, you know, again, having that backup, having a protection of a lawyer, I just think it's going to save everybody's career in the long run and in the short run.
I have no doubt that that is true. And, you know, I'm sure you remember that one of the reasons I ended up going to law school was having been forced into near bankruptcy by a bad management deal. And it made me decide, you know, this business is just painful, you know, and so it, you know, there comes a time where you have to think to yourself, I'm not going to put myself in this situation ever again. And you know, if I was to give people one piece of advice to go away and think about as they leave, is that remember, you need to negotiate everything you do up front before anything else happens. That's the time to do it, you know, whether it's a songwriting issue. Make sure that you understand how you're going to be compensated at the front end. Don't wait for somebody else to tell you at the end that you're not going to get paid for that. You know, the great Steve Lukather from Toto used to have a great rule, and his rule was, if you're in the room when the song is written, you get songwriting credit. And that's a noble way to be, and it's the fair way to be, but unfortunately not everybody does it. And nothing splits up a band faster than when the royalty money starts coming in, and you think, you know, you're in a very, very successful band, you're having a great time, and you're driving a new Ford Mustang, and you're making $150,000 a year, and everything is hunky-dory. Everything is great, till the singer, who may be the songwriter, turns up in the Ferrari Testarossa and announces he's just made $5 million. All of a sudden, things don't look so rosy.
Oh, you know,
that's why bands like U2 have lasted as long as they have, because they made the agreement between them right at the beginning that all songs will be written by U2.
Right, right.
And, you know, and it's maybe one of the reasons why the Police didn't last as long as they might have done, because, you know, that wasn't the rule for them.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Paul, it's been a pleasure having you again back on the show and, you know, just blessing us with your experience and knowledge on the front end side of the music, man. I really appreciate it, man, you know, for you coming back and, you know, sharing that knowledge with me. I would love to have you back and talk about some new things your way, man. You know, the musical agenda for 2010 and so forth. So,
you know what? It's always a pleasure to come on your show. I'll come back anytime. I mean, unfortunately, the legal business is very complex. The issues are very complex. You know, the nature of this is everything has to be done in generalities. I would tell everybody, if you have a question, call a lawyer. Find out what they have to say. If you ever you want to spend 30 minutes and talk about one specific issue, I'll make sure I'm completely up on the state of the law as of the day of the show, and we can do it. But I think you do a great service for everybody, and I'm honored that you asked me to help out.
Oh, man, thank you so much, man. I appreciate that. We'll definitely keep in touch, Paul.
Absolutely will. Take care, but thank you so much.
Thank you. And a big thank you and shout out to Mr. Paul Quinn for coming on the show and chopping it up with me and providing us this valuable information and wealth of knowledge of the business and the legal end of music. You know, a lot of times we get so caught up in creating the music and, you know, making ourselves a better artist or a musician. You know, we don't tend to spend as much time as we need to on the business and legal end of music, you know, so to have Paul come back and give us, you know, just the basics of what he deals with on a day-to-day basis with contracts and things, you know, it's, again, it's an honor, and I learned a lot on the show. So again, big thank you to Paul Quinn. And for my past and current interviews, you can hit my website up at www.myspace.com/SpudsNewZone. And I also host a podcast on iTunes, so if you have a computer and iPhone, go to your iTunes store and type in the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, click on my image, and you'll have a list of my past and current interviews as well. And for questions and suggestions, you can hit my email up at spudtootight@gmail.com. And I want to thank everybody for tuning and listening in. Until next time, you guys keep it tight. Peace.